Yes, welcome to Radio Freedom, otherwise known as Big Mouth, the pop culture podcast that roundly slaps you on the shoulders and shouts Iman's motivational memes at you until you feel better. I'm Sian Pattenden, and while Andrew Harrison is away, I'll be your cultural spirit animal, guiding us through the magical forest that is TV, books and film. It's all right, he's back next week. On this week's show, we'll be looking at Manifest, the new Sky One series. A plane disappears in 2013, and 5 years later, it makes a landing. What happened up there? Nobody knows yet. Plus, The Great Hack is out now on Netflix. What does big tech do with our data that we so willingly provide? Clue, quite a lot. And how much could the current extreme political climate owe to the machinations of Facebook advertising, Cambridge Analytica, data mining and fake news? And did Aaron Banks have any hope in hell of banning it? Phew. We'll also be bringing back the old favourite, the album No One Likes But Me. Some shockers in there today, thanks. Plus, in our famous extra bit, the best summer albums and tracks to keep us going in the long August days, where there is almost literally nothing to do. We have two special guests with us today. The first is an author, illustrator and all-round pop music swot. And among her pop-inspired kids' books is, I have to mention it again, The Cow Who Fell to Earth, in which a cosmic animal lands on Earth and everyone says, hello, space cow. Hi, Nadia Shireen.
Hello.
Welcome back to Big Mouth.
Thank you for having me back.
How is the world of children's publishing? I need to ask.
You need to ask immediately.
I need to ask.
It's great.
Yes.
It's good. My sequel to Billy and the Beast, Billy and the Dragon, came out a month ago, which features... Well, I say it's good. Okay, let me lay this all down.
Yeah, do this.
So there was a story in The Guardian that ran about 2 months ago, just talking about how still, despite lots of squawking about things, the characters that appear in our children's books, the amount of characters that are... BAME, to mm-hmm. use that acronym for Black Minority Ethnic, is still less than 1%. Mm. And it did... The piece really depressed me, because while those stats are true, there was no effort... No one kind of went and spoke to any of the many Black Ethnic Minority practitioners out there.
Right. Yes.
Or specialist bookshops that have popped up, like Knights Of in Brixton, or specialist publishers, or... It just made me tear my hair out. And I thought, mm-hmm. why am I bothering? I had a Twitter rant, which then I really kind of regretted, because it was, I think you should never tweet or write anything in public in anger, because it does make you look like a bit of a wally. Mm. And there was some stuff I regretted about it, because if you make picture books, if you make children's books, it's quite a tough market anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough market for everyone. But I think what I wanted to point out was that at this stage, this has been a long-running conversation within children's books in this country.
Yes, it's been running for decades.
It's been running for a while, and people are making the books, and publishers are waking up to it and are publishing the books. But if no one sells the books... then what's the point? If WH Smith, for example, or you know, your big supermarkets are only going to stock maybe 3 or 4 picture books from, or you know, children's books from big established heavy hitters, then what's the point?
Yeah.
So someone is not making an effort somewhere.
I see. I had a very glib answer to
Did
all
you?
This.
Go on.
But having dipped my toe in the publishing industry before, I thought we could ban leather patches from corduroy jackets.
Do you
ban
think that
those geriatric people who are really still in 1945. And I thought that might work, and just sort of bring in some new blood. But maybe I
don't know.
Cheaply.
I feel really weird and conflicted about the whole thing. Mm. And I could talk for several hours about this, because I make picture books, but I make them about animals and people and all
and
sorts
get your
of
pop
things.
References
and
in.
I get my pop references in just for a laugh. And I don't. I'm scared of becoming like the brown picture book maker. So I don't know. It's a thorny one.
It is. Thorny is the right word. We have another special guest this week. What legendary PR Mick Houghton doesn't know about difficult pop stars and dead farm animals you can write on the back of a bus ticket to a remote island in the Scottish Highlands, representing the likes of The Teardrop Explodes, KLF, Talking Heads, House of Love, Echo and the Bunny Man, Jesus and Mary Chain, Undertones, etc, etc. He's lived the music PR dream. Dead sheep, cash nailed to wooden pallets, curry with the Ramones and getting felt into smash hits. It's all in his memoir Fried and Justified, which is a jolly good read and out now on Faber. Hello, Mick. Welcome to Big
Mouth. Hello. And I was just thinking about you wanting to ban you know, the corduroy, the patches on corduroy jackets.
Yeah, so dear, is this a problem?
No. It just occurred to me that working with all these dysfunctional groups, the point when you know it's all starting to go wrong is when they suddenly turn up and it's, you know, midday, bright sunlight, and they're all wearing dark glasses. That's it. Suddenly it's like, we want to be cool now.
Ah.
And what's the first way you get to be cool? You wear dark glasses.
Yeah, so these are indicators.
They're indicators. The other great indicator is that when you start working with people, you know, you set up an interview and say, can you be at Smash Hits at 3 o'clock? It's fine, we'll be there. And then some idiot at the record company decides to get them picked up in a cab. So they're picked up in a cab, and no longer after that will they take the bus or get on the train. It's like, oh, can you get me a cab? So demanding cabs, wearing dark glasses, that's it.
OK, ban them.
Ban them all.
One thing I wanted to say, Mick, you could have tried a bit harder to get some cool people in the book. You've got Julian Cope, David Byrne, Jerry Ramone, Kim Gordon, Bill Drummond, Ian McCulloch. I mean, come on, sort it out.
Well, Lawrence is there.
What I'm saying is it's the epitome of cool. We'll talk about Fried and Justified very shortly. But, Mick, writing the book, it must include spilling beans on the pop stars. Are they still talking to you?
Actually, I can't have spilled enough beans because everybody, apart from the people that weren't talking to me anyway, which is most of them.
Oh, OK.
And not because I did anything, but you maybe it's just me, but most of the people I've worked with, when you stop working with them you sort of know when the time comes that, you know, you've done what you can do or they've done what they can do, so it all ends. I haven't really kept touch with that many people. I mean, the exceptions, to some extent, are Bill Drummond and Jimmy Courtney.
Yeah.
I don't know. I sometimes wonder with this book, because it's actually, to be honest with you, it's quite an affectionate account of my story or the story of all the people I've worked with, because I think that's how I wanted to write. I think that's how I wanted to write it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's me, to be honest with you. And but a few people have said, "Oh, you pulled your punches there, haven't you?"
Oh, right.
I don't think I have actually. I just wanted to. It's not that I only wanted to write about the good times, because I think there's some quite depressing moments in the book, usually about me. I don't know. People have this idea that music books should all be like, you know, Led Zeppelin's Hammer of the Gods or something like that. And it's not.
The dirt.
You know, it was actually, you were there, Sean. It was actually quite innocent in a way. It was quite innocent.
Yeah. We'll get into the details of it. Joseph and Ancient, I think you're right. There is a very, you have an avuncular view, I think, of pop music, which is wonderful. We need our regular but essential Patreon reminder, because you can get every edition of Big Mouth a day early by supporting us with a few quid on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. We're asking for the mere price of a pint, just £5 a month, to help fund our studio costs, and we'll send you each episode of the show as soon as it's ready. You'll get the extra bit too, exclusive to our Patreon backers. No one else can hear it. This week, Mick and Nadia are going to stick around, and they're going to tell us their favourite summer albums and tracks. You also now get an unreservedly beautiful Big Mouth mug if you're on the £10 tier, designed by us. So all, please pledge on. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more. Fried and Justified recounts Mick Houghton's life as PR to the most primitively savant and yet the most mad bastard pop groups of the 70s, 80s and 90s. We're going to hear a little bit of some songs which are mentioned in the book just to give us a flavour of that time. Here's Upside Down by Jesus and Mary Jane, Bill Drummond Said by Julian Cope and Never Stop by The Bunnymen.
Straight through the mouth, poison to come back in.
Okay, Mick Houghton, you've written a memoir of working as a PR for the coolest and yet most dysfunctional groups in rock history. From Julian Cope pouring a jar of honey all over himself at the Hammersmith Palais before he starts severing himself with a broken mic stand, to the KLF nailing money to bits of wood. Mick was there. Actually there. What made you want to write the book in the first place?
Well, I think I've been talking about it for years. Anybody that knows me says, oh, I've got to write this book. But I was actually... Not I was scared to write it, but I wasn't confident enough to write it because I knew that the only way it could work was if it was my book, if it was a book about me, essentially, not about, you know, all the people I work with. Otherwise, it just becomes a litany of little biographies of Equine the Bunnymen and Julian Cope. And I found it really difficult to put myself into the story. I think the first draft, I was barely in it. And I said, look, you've got to put yourself in this book.
Yeah.
And maybe I put too... I don't know. Sometimes I think I put too much of myself into it, but probably not.
Really?
Probably not. I think most of the stories about... some of the, well, not most, but a lot of the stories about people behaving idiotically were about myself.
It captures a time in the music industry where independent labels are actually run by people in their bedrooms or living rooms who just wanted to put out a record. People went to art school, formed bands, started having hit records, went mental. These are all the tropes we now know is what being a rock star is. It was invented at this time. You seem to have become a press officer also by accident.
Oh, yeah, I mean, totally. I thought... I didn't want to be a press officer. I hate the word, the term press officer.
Oh, yes,
you have to call me a publicist or I'll walk out now. But I was, I guess, a press officer when I started because I took a job at WEA Records, which actually was based on, do people know where you are at doing this broadcast?
Tell us.
You're on Broadwick Street.
Tell us where we are.
Well, you're on Broadwick Street.
Yes.
And on the corner of Broadwick Street was WEA Records, which was still there, I think, at the end of the 80s. Anyway, I was asked to come in and become their... in-house writer. Big record company says in-house writer. So you wrote all the press releases and biogs. And they'd sacked the guy that was there before me because he'd been nicking stuff from the boardroom and selling it. Even in the days before eBay, you know, people stole stuff and sold it.
Yeah.
So I just came in for like a month and it was just, I'd been a freelance journalist. It was just a gig, really. And as you know, freelance writing is quite lonely sometimes. So it was really nice to be part of an office for a while. But while I was there, WEA licensed Sire Records. And I was amazed that nobody within the company actually had heard of it. They hadn't heard of Sire. Mm. They didn't seem to know who the Ramones were or Talking Heads were.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very much an American-based company, so... It was all about Linda Ronstadt and the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac. So I think I was just enthusiastic about all these bands. And Moira Bellis, who was my boss, just said, well, look, why don't you stay on and look after the press?
I say press officer because Bill Drummond writes the intro in your book in which he says that he thought press officers pressed the records quite physically.
He did.
And so, I mean, again, it's the dark arts, wasn't it, at that point? I think a lot of people didn't know what you did with your time.
No,
just stuffed the record in a
mailbag. I think that's it. I mean, it's like the hardest thing when you met bands for the first time. You know, all meetings with bands are difficult, far more difficult than interviewing them as a journalist. Because I think when you interview somebody as a journalist, they kind of know what you're doing.
Yeah.
But most bands, I guess because the fact that they were signed to Warner Brothers or whatever label, it actually meant they'd had a bit of press already and they'd done all that themselves. So they had this view that Bill is very funny in his introduction, that basically all you did was you mailed the records to The Enemy, to Melody Maker, Sounds and Record Mirror.
Yeah.
And as Bill puts it, which was true with the Zoo records that he was looking after, which was the Teardrop Explosion, Echo and the Bunnymen, you know, you get a couple of singles of the week and you were off and running.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was all very formulaic. You went, you know, you got your single of the week, you got your first feature, you got a live review. You could chart the progress of groups just through the four music papers. So suddenly they meet this person and says, this is your new publicist. And they're can you swear on this programme?
Of course you can.
So basically, most groups looked at you and said, you know, what the fuck are you here for? Because why? Why do we need you? And sometimes you come along with a journalist and they think, why couldn't the journalists have made their own way there? You know, why do they need to be accompanied by a publicist? So it was quite difficult because to one degree or another, you experience quite a lot of hostility towards you because, like I say, you know, especially if you were from the record company, and I also worked with a lot of northern groups, and I do think there was a sort of north-south divide to some extent, and you know, I was this kind of softly spoken southerner, probably sounding a bit posh, which I'm not, but you know, so yeah, they just don't really know why you're there and what you do, and it takes a while. It takes a while to win people around, and the only way you can win people around, I think, is to, it's just one, keep coming back. I mean, you keep going to gigs, you get to know people. I don't even think it's about doing a good job, because to some extent, in the early days, if a band, say like Echo and the Bunnymen, makes their debut album, I think the groups kind of think, well, we would have got all those brilliant reviews whether you were involved or not, and they're probably right, actually. Because the secret of good PR is just not to work on anything that's shit. Because if you work on something good, it's easier.
Yeah, difficult though, if you get delivered something that isn't as good as maybe previous records.
But you wouldn't, I get the impression from your book that you wouldn't waste time trying to talk something up that you knew wasn't much top.
No.
And that's probably why you were well regarded by journalists as well as trusted by bands. But, and did you, have you, sorry to jump in with a cue, but I was interested to know how you have observed the change of the balance of power. I mean, now the press doesn't exist in the way that it did, but did you observe the shift, the balance of power going from maybe the musicians to the press?
And, you know, I think the music press was still important, certainly towards the end of the 90s. I mean, you know, I work with someone like Spiritualized, and, you know, they're, you know, breakthrough album, if you like, was Ladies and Gentlemen, We're Floating in Space, and that was totally broken through the music press, and that, I guess, particularly the NME, but by then you had Q, and you had, you know, the press had changed,
and was it around then that broadsheets would be writing about pop music?
I mean,
that
broadsheets
was a shift as well.
I mean, broadsheets when I started didn't really cover pop music at all. You might get the odd review in the Guardian. The Sunday Times had a writer called Derek Jewell who did a weekly column, and Derek Jewell only seemed to write about awful prog bands that wanted to marry rock music and classical music together.
Oh dear.
So yeah, so if you wanted to read glowing, you know, a glowing piece about ELP, then the Sunday Times is for you. But no, it's funny, even when I started, I thought it was important to try and get my groups, as I call them, into the broadsheets. And I remember being really thrilled that we got a feature in The Guardian about the new psychedelia, which was basically Echo and the Bunnymen and the Teardrop Explodes. I mean, they hated it. They hated the fact that
they didn't want to be lumped in
as the new psychedelia.
Yeah.
But the only way I knew you could get them in The Guardian at that point was to come up with an angle.
So no band's going to want to be lumped into any scene, are they? But then they sort of, that's the poison chalice. Yeah. You kind of have to be lumped. Like, no band ever wanted to be called a Britpop band, did they?
Of course not. No.
But on the other hand,
actually, in a way, I got away with it, because what those bands hated even more was being called the New Merseybeat. You
know, right.
That was the other one.
So you talk about your role as the bands are sort of feeling their way to see what your role is. Does your role at some stage as PR turn into the psychotherapist, the, as we're saying, avuncular figure, when you're indeed nursing them into success? It's your job to give them success, and yet, as we know, fame is a fickle mistress.
It is indeed.
And through this book, what's so interesting about this book is you're very honest about these human beings who become pop stars, and then they're wrestling with what success actually is. You're not painting them as gods from the outset.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, I was an avuncular figure, because I was actually, I mean, when I started in 78 as a publicist, I nearly said press officer. I was 28, and most of the bands I was working with were in their early 20s. And so I guess I wasn't a avuncular figure. I mean, what saved me was that I was so into music that the only way they could relate to me in some ways was because I knew a lot about music. I could talk a lot about music. And for a lot of them, I'd seen and or interviewed all these groups that were their heroes. So, you know, I'd seen The Doors. I'd seen, you know, I'd interviewed Lou Reed. You know, I'd interviewed all their heroes in some cases. I remember when I started working with a a group called Gorky's Psychotic Monkey, and this wasn't until the mid-90s. Mm. You know, and the press would describe them as... the press kind of... All their influences were people like Kevin Ayers and the Bonzo Dog Band and the Incredible String Band, and they were painted as this bunch of hippies that lived in a caravan, which they didn't. But, you know, I'd seen the Incredible String Band. I'd interviewed Gene Clark. I'd interviewed all their heroes. Mm. And that made things a lot easier because... Mm. And I think the book maybe... Actually, the book doesn't. I think the blurb on the back stresses this too much. Is that Mick was all about the music, which I kind of was, but it was actually all about the people. It's all about the people. Yeah. That's the thing.
Who's the worst offender for ringing you up in the middle of the night with some crisis or another?
You know what? That was really rare.
Really?
In fact, I can't even think when that ever happened. One, I wouldn't have answered the phone anyway.
They used to do it in the 90s. They used to ring us up.
Really? Honestly, I cannot remember anybody ringing up in the middle of the night with a crisis.
I'm quite surprised. You dealt with Lawrence from Felt.
I don't think Lawrence had a phone.
Did he have a phone? I was
Lawrence
about to say he would have had a phone.
Oh,
he would have sent a postcard in the middle
of the night. Well, this is it. Lawrence
Mick,
didn't
he
have
got a phone.
Did he get a phone?
So whenever I interviewed Lawrence and he was in the NME or Smash Hits or something like that, I would get quite a lot of calls.
Really?
And I'd have to read him out the stuff that I've written and stuff, and then he'd come back and give me some more quotes. He was never off the phone, Mick.
He used to tell me he didn't have a phone, so...
He lived in Sloane Street.
I thought he only accepted, like, colourful postcards or something. Anyway, is it not true?
Yeah.
That's how he was to me. No, Lawrence... I mean, Lawrence is a case in point. Lawrence... You know, I actually worked with Lawrence from about... I don't know, when he signed to Creation, and I worked on what I still think is his best album and the best album that Creation Records released in the 90s, which is Felt's Forever Breathes a Lonely World.
Yes.
It's a fantastic album. It's a pop album, and Creation wasn't geared towards pop music.
Right.
And so I worked with him from then right through to about 2000 when he was doing... Go-Kart Mozart, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
And the thing about Lawrence is that, you know, we talked about this earlier, Lawrence, it was hard not to like Lawrence. And he was infuriating, absolutely infuriating, because he made ridiculous demands. Lawrence, I think, wanted to be a pop star, but everything about him said, I could never be a pop star.
Yes.
But at the same time, he made the kind of demands upon people, not particularly on me, but on other people, which you would only get away with if you were a massive pop star. And say, I'm not doing that unless you do this. This artwork, the barcode on this sleeve is wrong. It's got to be changed. and people would patiently agree.
Yeah. That's called charisma.
Called charisma.
Julian Cope comes across very well.
He had charisma as well.
And yes. And that you seemed at one point quite close, whether that's the real reality of it. But for someone who is perceived as someone who went... quite mental, that he was demented by fame and drugs. He's reasonable in this. You don't paint him out as to be this shamanic, wayward character.
No, not at all. I think the exciting period working with Julian with the Teardrop Explodes, and it was the same time as the Bunnymen. I mean, for me, it was all new to me, and we did all take a lot of drugs and did some silly things and had plenty of crazy times. Actually, I think with the Teardrops, I never went on the road with the Teardrops. If you've read Head On, which I'm sure you have, there's all these stories about ridiculously wild goings-on tour in America or Australia. And I never went on any of those. And I think if I did, I'd be dead. You know, the amount of drugs they were taking, I could not have consumed. But Julian, we were good. We were friends. We were really quite close friends. And the most difficult time was when the Teardrops were split up, and he released two solo albums, and they were both absolutely panned. I mean, Fried, the Fried of the cover, the Fried in the title of the book, Fried was the second one, and now it's held up and revered as his classic album.
Yeah.
But at the time, it got terrible reviews, and the one before got even worse reviews. And he was really troubled then, but to some extent, if you've read his other book, Repossessed, he actually went into retreat for a few years, and you know, he got married, he was living in Tamworth, so I didn't really have a lot to do with him. But we were really close, and we didn't work together for a few years when he went signed to Island Records and had his kind of resurrection with World Shut Your Mouth. And then I think by the beginning of the 90s, you know, he was having problems with Island Records, and he kind of we reconnected, and I don't think I'd spoken to him for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. And I think the 90s was just this incredible period for Julian, because he was so creative then. He made probably his best work, his best albums, Peggy Suicide, but definite. But he was also researching this great tome of his, The Modern Antiquarian. You know, he wrote Head On, or he published Head On, his autobiography. And I mean, I felt that all through the 90s, all I wanted to do, I think, was to get people to take Julian seriously, because I was sick of him being treated as some kind of rock nutter.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is similarly with Lawrence. I mean, people, you know, the music press tended to put people in that box, didn't they?
We can take the KLF here and say that Paul Drummond and Jimmy Courtney were treated in that way. How on earth did you deal with that? It's the snowball effect of KLF and their, I mean, what they don't like them being described as is pranks do they? But their situationist style assault on the music industry.
It's weird in a way with it was the Jams to begin with, and I guess it sort of started slowly and it built up towards the end. In a way, most of what I was doing was quite reactive. I mean, they would go off and do stuff, and I would deal with the aftermath of that.
Yes, operation.
Yeah, whether it was, you know, climbing the walls of the National Theatre Building and writing 1987 on it, or burning £1 million. Because by that stage, certainly, they weren't doing interviews. They weren't really fronting anything. So I became basically the person that got called up whenever they did something.
And you say in the book that sometimes it was best to know not what they were doing and to be as innocent as everyone else. So when the press rang you up and you said, actually, I genuinely don't know, you didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, denial's much easier if you don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. why did you want to get out? Why do you not do PR anymore?
Oh, God. It had changed. I mean, I think it began to change. It's what Nadia said earlier. It began to change by the noughties. I think it wasn't so much the advent of online PR, but I think the print media was less influential. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really understand. I actually still don't to some extent. I didn't really understand how social media worked. And to be honest with you, I actually think I often thought about this with the KLF. The KLF would not have worked in the current climate, because the KLF worked, or particularly the K Foundation stuff, because they used the music press and they used print. Mm. And when they launched their, you know, Abandon All Art campaign, it was done through the press. They took out back page ads on The Guardian, on The Enemy, on The Independent, which told people what they were doing. They weren't putting out press statements. They were just putting out these fantastic statements using the media.
Yeah.
And I don't think that would work now, because you could put it on YouTube or something and millions of people would see it, but it wouldn't mean anything. It wouldn't make any impact whatsoever. Mm. I think the print media was it was quite narrow, but therefore you could influence people more easily, I guess, and manipulate people more easily.
Yeah.
Now it just strikes me, it strikes me it's very hit and miss.
And you're shouting into a cardboard box, really, aren't you?
Yeah.
Hit and miss, yeah. Before we move on, we're going to play your favourite song from the golden days of PR, as I'm calling it. We're playing Spiritualized and Think I'm in Love. Why did you choose this?
Yeah, I don't think it's my favourite song of all of them, but I chose it partly because, actually, I've done a lot of these things and a lot of talks now, and we never seem to get past the KLF. And we never seem to get past Liverpool, really. And I'm glad today we talked about Lawrence, which is good. Mm. We never talk about the Jesus and Mary chain either, for some reason.
There's so much stuff in the book. But we can recommend people read it, because there's so many bands.
Do read it.
Read
yes.
the book. It's all
and
in there.
So many people you've worked with.
But Spiritualized, I think, because in a way, I think Spiritualized and that album, Ladies and Gentlemen, was probably the last time I felt... I mean, it was the thing with me... I always wanted to make a difference. That was what it was about. So you want to make a difference to something, make a difference to the people you're working with. And I think I did with that album. And that's not to say, you know, I could ever put myself forward and say, hey, that wouldn't have happened but for me, but for the press. But you're part of something, you're part of a process. And I also think with that album and with Jason Pierce, you know, everyone had told me not to work with him because he was so difficult. And I didn't find that. I mean, I just found him really easy to get on with.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, you know, the first time we met, we spent about 6 hours talking about Elvis Presley.
And also, you thought that maybe one of the reasons why he took you on was you had three cats, which I thought was a really nice bit of detail.
Well, actually, no, I was vetted. Probably a bad word there. I was vetted by Kate Radley, who was in the band.
Yeah.
And I think the three cats... I think she was more impressed by the three cats.
Okay.
And actually, Jason did quite like the cats as well.
Yeah. Well, that's the kind of PR that I can get behind.
So, but anyway, so that's why, because I want to talk about, I wanted to mention Spiritualized at long last.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah. Think I'm in Love by Spiritualized. By now, most of us are vaguely familiar with the scandal involving Cambridge Analytica and the 2016 Trump and Leave.eu campaigns. Journalist Carol Cadwallader uncovered the fact that Facebook users' data had been mined to target undecided voters through fake psychology tests and using highly inflammatory advertising. That's in quotes. New Netflix doc The Great Hack follows up with stories from the whistleblowers themselves, plus key players in the whole saga, which goes on and on, including Cambridge Analytica former COO Julian Wheatland. Personal data seems to have been weaponized. We now have so-called information warfare. From the start of this, there are clear heroes and villains in this piece. So let's start the paranoia now by listening to the trailer.
The real game changer was Cambridge Analytica.
They'd worked for the Trump campaign and for the Brexit campaign.
They started using information warfare.
Cambridge Analytica claimed to have 5,000 data points on every American voter.
I started tracking down all these Cambridge Analytica ex-employees.
Someone else that you should be calling to the committee is Brittany Kaiser.
At one point in this trailer, whistleblower Brittany Kaiser says data is now worth more than gold in global value. This is the new information age. Boom, boom, boom. Nadia, what did you make of The Great Hack?
Well, I mean, obviously the facts of what we're looking at are well known and terrifying. Yeah. So I'm not disputing it, you know, any of that. I was one of those. I do have a Facebook account, and when all the Cambridge Analytica stuff came out, I was very like, oh God, you know, should I still have one? I still am a bit like, oh, why do I still have one? And shall I just delete my entire digital footprint? But I'm too egotistical, so I probably won't. So whilst that's very interesting, I did have some issues with The Great Hack as a documentary.
Yeah.
How it was filmed, how the participants that took part. It at times it felt a bit like, you know, Titanic, the film Titanic. A really big thing happens in Titanic. The story is big enough. Yeah. Do you then need to add on the love story? And that's kind of how I felt about The Great Hack, is that the story I feel is compelling enough. Do you really need to shoehorn in loads of kind of not very compelling graphics? And I had quite a problem with Brittany Kaiser.
Right.
Who I felt... So she was an employee of Cambridge Analytica. Some people say she was a whistleblower. Other people say she wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
So our girl Carol says no, she wasn't a whistleblower. Mm. But anyway, she did come out, she did testify, she did talk about her experience as an employee and her work with, say, for example, the Leave EU campaign. Mm. A lot of her statements contradicted the CEO of Cambridge Analytica. What's his name? The shifty-looking guy.
Alexander Nix. Yeah. He doesn't come across well.
Alexander Nix, who just looks like, if you just saw him in the street, you'd be like, shifty.
Mm.
He's just got that air, hasn't he? Proper shifty air. But anyway, a lot of the stuff that she says contradicts him. She's quite young. She must have been really young when she was doing all of this.
Mm.
I felt really conflicted about her inclusion in the documentary. I questioned her motives. I don't know if I was meant to feel sorry for her They kind of interview her in this infinity pool in Thailand.
Yes, in an unnamed location.
Unnamed location. Sorry, I've just said it's Thailand. But, you know, an unnamed location.
Well, in Thailand.
I don't know. There was just... I'm not articulating very well, but I was slightly just irritated by... I felt like the filmmakers were desperately scrabbling about for some kind of redemption arc with her. Mm. And they wanted us to relate to her.
I completely agree. It's like the only character in the film that I think comes across well is Carol Cadwallader.
Yeah.
Because she's the only one that at any point is angry.
Yeah.
I mean, she swears. She says fuck a lot. And then everyone else is kind of fudging around the issues.
Yeah.
And, Brittany Kaiser... I found that quite strange, and just the way she was filmed, and it's like the way you think she's done all these bad things, and nobody's really taking issue with that. And at the same time, she's swanning around, staying in really good hotels,
lovely hotels,
bathing in pools, but I think that was part. I think that was a problem with the whole program. Nobody's taken to task at the end.
No,
the worst that seems to happen to the vile Alexandra Nix, and even Zuckerberg, is that they have to sit before these congressional hearings, and they're made to squirm a bit.
Mm. That is literally the worst thing that happens to them.
That's the worst thing that happens to them. And you kind of assume now
and they have
that,
to give some of their pocket money at the end of the day. For sweets, but they won't really notice.
No.
But that's it. I suspect now they're still, they're still comfortable.
Oh, they're fine.
And if they're not involved in what they were involved then somebody else is. It just feels like everyone's let off the hook, really.
And the
documentary, it just makes you aware of things that you already knew about. Mm-hmm. And occasionally there's something like the Duso campaign in Trinidad and Tobago.
Yeah, which is very interesting. Yes.
That was extraordinary.
Yes, jaw-dropping. Yes, the Trinidad and Tobago campaign where they persuade young people not to vote.
I mean, encouraging people to be apathetic.
And they've even got a dance and a rap, and it's on YouTube, and you suddenly see how the information that we take just goes into a completely different direction.
And it's so easy to do. And this is not... I'm not implicating this Russell Brand at all, but it did make me think of him. Because do you remember when he briefly flirted with, hey, kids, don't vote, when he had his own thing?
Yes,
and it did make me think, it would be so ridiculously easy to do.
Mm.
You'd do it in seconds over here, couldn't you?
Mm.
That's what really stopped me from really engaging with this documentary, was I was just irritated by, now let's film Brittany Kaiser going down a lift and getting in an Uber, and let's put some music behind it.
Well, I'm going to beg to differ in the fact that the filmmakers want to make a documentary as soon as possible, but the story isn't over. We're at the start of the story. We haven't, I think, even got to the tip of the iceberg. Google in it. Well, the data that Google have and what they are meant to do with it, which is throw it away, which they probably don't, all sorts of stories, and they've got the coup in getting Brittany Kaiser. She is the linchpin of this whole thing. We follow her. We have more access to her than the Carol Cadwallader at points. And yet there's lots of things that she's obviously not saying. Her relationship with Alexandra Nix is obviously odd.
There is something
has happened.
There's something going on there, isn't there?
She also doesn't seem to be not drinking wine in a lot of things. This is a very vulnerable person. What I'm saying is we're seeing someone in the middle of this absolute crisis. Mm-hmm. And therefore... it doesn't quite work in a neat, put it in a box, this is what Cambridge Analytica did, and everybody. It's that this is an ongoing story, and everybody is in the middle of receiving.
I think that's absolutely
receiving
right.
The bill.
Yeah.
I mean, she does look haunted throughout the whole film.
Yes, doesn't she?
But somehow you don't sympathise with her.
I don't know if she's haunted for the right reasons. And inverted.
You're so tough.
Do you know what I mean? No, but I don't think
she got
she
found
is.
Out.
Yeah, and I don't think she's haunted because she thinks, I did a terrible thing, then I must atone so that I can be friends with my old friends anymore. Maybe that's me being really cynical.
It's weird when Alexandra Nix texts her.
I know, right?
To say you did okay there.
Really odd, and that speaks to a strange
suggesting that there is a lot of things that are still uncovered that are going on between them. But there is a scene where she absolutely has to get on a plane. She suddenly feels she's been found out and she's hiding. She is frightened for her life in that point, I thought. And I felt for her. She's conflicted and she's not perfect. But she just looks like, fuck, I just got to go or else...
Maybe. I felt weirdly, I felt a little flicker of empathy, if not sympathy, for Julian Wheatland at one point, the co-founder or the founder of...
Chief Operating Officer
of Cambridge Analytica, when he said, quite rightly, it sucks for me that there was always going to be a Cambridge Analytica. It just sucks for me it was Cambridge Analytica. And I thought, yeah, absolutely. He's got closest to really addressing the problem.
Yeah, I mean, the other whistleblower, the guy with the red hair...
Chris Wiley.
I mean, he gets totally brushed under the carpet by saying, well, he only became a whistleblower because... He didn't get the job, and he got offered a better job, so they don't really follow up on him. And I think he was the initial whistleblower, as I understand it.
Yes, I think he
and
was.
And then Brittany Kaiser came on board later.
Maybe something happened between him and the filmmakers. She said, speculating wildly, but like maybe it did.
Maybe. I thought that they were trying to do in the choreography of this narrative. She said poshly, is that they're making a film noir. We start with David Carroll, who's essentially the private eye.
Yeah.
And he's the guy who's talking to the students, and it's his voice over there. And then we have the goodies and the baddies. We have Carol, we have Alexander. And then we have the femme fatale, Brittany Kaiser, who you don't know whose side she's on. It's actually a Humphrey Bogart film, the whole thing.
Do you reckon?
Yeah.
I tell you what, in Humphrey Bogart films, you never had... The femme fatale was never seen in steampunk gear. Burning Man,
well, also,
which if anything's going to make me not sympathise with someone, it's someone wearing steampunk gear. Yeah.
But also, there's no Humphrey Bogart character in it.
David Carroll.
They could have done more with David Carroll.
Yeah.
I mean, David Carroll
making it into a fiction now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame that David Carroll just comes over as a kind of a nice guy who feels.
Yes, he doesn't.
You know, they've got I don't know. You totally believe him and why he's doing what he's doing, but he's not. He's just a bit of a ambiguous. You know,
he's not the most compelling.
No, not very compelling
guy, is he?
And you just kind of see him sitting there with his students. And,
Carol, though, what a hero! Carol. And I felt really proud, pathetically. I was like,
she's our Carol
now. Our Carol.
When
she's
puts
great.
On the leather jacket and goes to the Guardian, I thought, I love your leather jacket. Oh,
love
I mean, this is this
love
is
her look. I know that's not what I should be getting out of it, but yeah, I was like,
she's
I
a
also,
new reader.
I also assumed she probably smoked cigarettes as well.
She looks like it.
She looks like a
sort.
Yeah,
and you're not allowed to smoke on these things. You know,
we could go out for a night with Carol.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She looks like a good egg.
Yeah, yeah. I love the great irony of watching a Netflix documentary going, they're using our data. Oh, and I did delete my Facebook account because I hate
it.
Yeah, well, I hate it and I don't really use it.
I know, I should.
But Netflix is obviously using our viewing figures. It's using our location.
Exactly.
It's using. Yeah. It's just like, while we're watching it, we're giving Netflix all the data. But I just think, oh, God, it's this circle of hell, isn't
it? Yeah, 100%. I was like, well, I'll delete my Facebook. Will I then delete
my
Instagram?
I went into prep before this. And, mm-hmm. and I know when I'll get home, there'll be a text from me asking me to if I enjoyed my visit to press.
Really?
And
did they do that?
They do that.
Oh, what? Because have you ever said you'll have your receipt emailed?
No. I've gone into places, shops, and not bought anything. And I don't know what it is, but
wow.
you sort of feel that who's following me around here? It's very weird. It's very
I've thought about that and sort of thought my life is not interesting enough that in a way it's like, well, have the data, mate, because you're not going to get much out of it. It's like, go
That's
for your
what
life.
They want you to think.
I
but
know.
Collected together, Nadia, you're a powerful
Wake
force.
Wake up, sheeple.
So you're telling me that my Ocado order, when I buy soya milk rather than skim milk, is this telling them something about
they're
me?
They're going to make you vote for a different milk. You know?
With me, it's like, why all this gin and cat food?
That's
right.
Ours is mostly cat food and cat litter.
So, guys, come on. Would you recommend this to other people? Should we be waking up sheeple? Other sheeple? Sheeple on
I
the,
feel
on the
like
steps
it was,
of Grosvenor House Hotel.
How long was it? It was like an hour and a half. I'm not going to get back.
It was too long, actually.
It was too long.
An hour and 50, I think.
I think your time is better off spent reading Carol Cadwallader's Guardian pieces.
Right, yeah, and going
honestly,
off-grid.
Yeah, I didn't really think it was
that.
Buy
the papery version though, but don't read the
Buy the paper
maybe?
Version in a fedora, in an overcoat.
And dark glasses.
And then just put it in a bin.
Like the Bunnyman. Okay, fine. Right. Okay, back to the real world, such as it is. We always ask our guests to bring in a tune for the audience, their editor's recommendation. Nadia, what do you have for us today?
I have Lizzo feat. Missy Elliott with Tempo.
Yay!
I always wanted to be a pop star called Feet, just so that I could
feet.
Be. Yeah, it's like I'm in the charts about 10 times. This childish thought. Anyway, yeah,
Good
Lizzo.
Work. Keep with it.
Lizzo right. Feet Missy Elliott Tempo.
Yes.
I'm still on the Lizzo high after seeing her at Glastonbury. She just makes me very, very happy.
And what is good about Lizzo and Missy Elliott together?
oh, what isn't good? It's a powerhouse.
I think this is all about their bodily femininity, isn't it?
It's about being happy with your thick thighs. And it makes me feel better about my thick thighs, is basically, honestly, that's how, that was my window in.
Wonderful. Let's give it a listen. Missy Elliott. Oh, sorry. Lizzo feet. Missy Elliott with Tempo. Legendary slow songs, they for skinny hoes. Can't move all of this here to one of those. I'm a thick bitch, I need tempo. Fuck it up to the tempo. Fuck it up to the tempo. Fuck it up to the tempo. Slow songs, they for skinny hoes. Fuck it up to the tempo. Let's go, let's go, let's go. All the fly girls to the dance floor. Kitty cat, brrr. All the thick girls down on a brrr. Ice on my neck like brrr. I'm big bone with nice curves. Look at me, I know I look good. Look good, look good, look good. I'ma show y'all chicks how to do. Yo nigga, he wish he could. Right, sci-fi. Manifest is the new Sky One drama in which a group of people take a perfectly ordinary airplane journey. Of course, Flight 828. And the plane full of people disappears for 5 years. They are missing, presumed dead, although to the passengers and crew, it feels only like a few hours when they return. They themselves are changed somehow, but they don't know how. It's a bit like Lost, if you've seen that. Let's get a feel of the whole thing from the trailer.
If you'd seen us that afternoon, we looked like a typical American family returning home from vacation. My brother Ben and his twins, Olive and Cal. But what you couldn't see is that Cal's leukemia wasn't responding to treatment.
This flight is oversold. We are offering travel vouchers for anybody.
That's me.
So Grace and Olive and my folks took the first flight home. Funny how one little decision can ruin your life, but also save it.
Exactly is the problem?
The problem, ladies and gentlemen, is you've all been missing, presumed dead, for 5.5 years.
Well, I was looking forward to this, as it has an element of being complete fantasy, and I'm fed up of the real world and have been turning the radio off all week. Everything is far too polarised at the moment. Mick, can you set up Manifest a little for us?
I could try. I mean, I think my problem with it is that it's actually very cliched. I mean, planes are great things to use for something like this because you've got 100 or 199 people. Or if I think back to Flight of the Phoenix, or many, many back in the 50s, you've got half a dozen people disappearing in a plane goes down or disappears. And it's a good way of bringing a bunch of people together. Mm-hmm. And in this case, something mysterious has happened. You don't know what's happened. And you kind of wait, and I think it's the problem for me with this is that one, it's cliched, and two, I found the central family a bit cliched as well, the kind of core family, because even though there's 199 people in the plane, you've got to focus on a family.
Yes,
and I guess it's one of those. It was one of those things where I wasn't sure that I really cared with what had happened to them or not, but at the same time, you know. It's still very addictive because it strikes me it's been made for people that binge watch because it's basically
explicitly
it is basically junk food, which means that at the end of every episode, you know, there'll be a big reveal or a cliffhanger, which means that instead of going to bed, you think, oh, I'll just watch another one. And the problem I have with all these things is, even though I watched so many of them, is that 3 months later, you're flicking through on Amazon Prime and you come across this film again. And I think this would be the case with this. And you'd be thinking, have I seen that?
and then watch it again.
You probably realise once you've got into about three episodes. But you look at the premise and it's all about the premise, isn't it? It's all about the premise. And you know that even at the end of the first episode, I actually watched two, where the family's starting to, they're hearing voices and things are starting to happen. You kind of know, you do have to wonder what happens next.
I think the premise was really strong.
Yeah.
So I hadn't heard of it actually until because I don't have the channel it's on. So I was, when I heard about it, I was like, oh, I like this premise. So the premise is that this flight takes off in 2013 and is missing. Everyone's presumed dead. Mm. But for the people on the plane, they land and as if it was just a flight. There's a bit of turbulence.
Yeah.
They go through some horrific turbulence and then they land. And it turns out when they land that it's actually now 2018. Mm-hmm. So everyone on the plane is like, what the actual?
Yeah.
And everyone back on Earth is like, we thought you were dead. You've been dead for 5 years. Our lives have moved on.
Mm.
I thought it was a great premise. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed Lost. Mm-hmm. I was a Lost fan.
All right.
I even kept the faith until the end. I mean, I know it was Bobbins in a way, but I still, I did enjoy Lost. Mm. So I was like, oh, OK, is this going to be a bit of
a Lost?
You put
your Lost hat on.
I put my Lost hat on. And it reminded me a bit of a Stephen King short story called The Landoliers.
OK.
Which is slightly similar in that everyone, some people are on a plane and then they fall asleep and then like eight people wake up and they're the only people left on the plane and everyone else has disappeared and they're still in the air. So it's got, it had that, it had that vibe to it. I thought it was Bobbins. I'm so sorry, because I don't like going in knowing, I thought it was rubbish. But it was kind of like, the premise was really strong. So it did keep me watching. So I was like, okay, come on, what? But I thought the premise was so strong that they didn't then need to kind of layer quite kind of cynical, oh, and now you've got voices in your head and now we have special powers. And But my biggest problem was it looked like it was made for 50p. And it just had the air of a Channel 5 TV movie. Mm. And God knows I love a Channel 5 TV movie, but I love them when they're called things like Not Without My Daughter, or, you know, my son, a Mother's Tears. Or
she could never
kind of
let
thing.
Go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was all far too signposted, wasn't it?
Mm. It really was. And it just and also I thought the acting was just hilariously appalling, and I thought the dialogue was just really bad. Sorry. Yeah.
And you do know also that if you couldn't have downloaded the whole thing, you'd have watched episode one. And if you had to wait another week for episode two to come
out... Oh, you never would.
You wouldn't have bothered.
I mean, that said, I did watch episode one and I did... And I thought, fair enough, that was a pilot. So I should have watched a bit of the second one, because often the quality jump can be huge from a pilot episode to episode two.
That's wise words, mate. Yeah.
So I did watch the second episode, but it remained for me Bobbins. However, I might secretly watch another episode when I go home. Yeah.
I mean, the other annoying thing I found was that I didn't recognise anybody in it. So you couldn't play that game of like, oh, he was in 24.
No.
Wasn't he in Lost? Wasn't she in The X-Files?
It didn't look like it had a big stellar.
I don't think I recognised anybody. It wasn't even anybody from Call Them His Wife.
My faves for a TV movie, this is off topic, but for if you know you've got a good American TV movie from the 80s, it's got to have either or both Terry Garr and or Brian Dennehy.
No, nice. Yeah, well, they should have been drafted in, shouldn't they?
What do you think?
I was very disappointed. As I say, I wrote production values really big on my note
because there aren't any.
Because there aren't any. And we have, the main character seems to be this Michaela character who's a wasp. She's a white,
I know, right?
Pretty woman.
I forget her face while I'm looking at her.
Does anyone care? I mean, these are really big problems. It's incredibly old-fashioned. It has none. If they had drafted in Natasha Lyonne from Russian Doll and said, right, write the script and make this good, we could do it cheap. But if you actually had a script and some characters that weren't completely two-dimensional, you might get somewhere. I also thought it was signposting this quasi-religious stuff, which was weird. That everything happens for a reason sort of ideology behind it, and our idea of, as humans, what's our destiny? Do we do good? Do we do bad? Is that, as you say, a Channel 5 TV movie
really bothers.
Trying to be Lost. I think it's very hard to find a redeeming feature in Manifest, apart from the fact that it would be quite addictive if I had the Sky login. Which I gave away.
But it could have been so good. That's what angers me. It's such a good, strong premise, I think. Yeah. It could be really good.
And they all made an effort. They all turned up. They all did the line. Someone edited it. And yet...
Someone's watched The Dead Zone.
But the worst bit of production was when the plane blows up.
Oh, I was about to say, that was just comical.
It looks like something like out of Space 1999 or something. But it was terrible.
Really bad.
It didn't even blow up properly, did
it? No, it looked like a child had done it on After Effects.
Also, it's all from the point of view of the people who are on the plane. There's no point of view from the people who... So, like The Returned, which was really good.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Oh, it was excellent. It was about what happens when people come back into your lives. Uh-huh. They'd flipped it 180. And I think it's a more interesting story when you have been abandoned by the people up in the air, rather than them coming back and trying to work out what's going on. I think very elemental things made it very stodgy in the 80s.
Great recommendation there for Manifest.
Sorry. But
if you're like lost and you've got nothing to do, it's August, there's nothing to do.
Oh, no, there's still more that you could do than watch Manifest.
So who's recommending this to anybody at all?
Have a sleep. Just don't really? I would say have a sleep or watch Queer Eye.
And Mick, did you say you'd watched a couple?
I watched two.
You watched two episodes. So you're in there? No?
Well, I don't know. I'll either go back and watch another one tonight, but because I haven't got to, I don't think I will.
Okay, fair enough. Right, let's have another choice of music. Let's get back to what we know from one of our guests. Mick, you've brought in something that sounded to me a little bit folky.
It is. And you know, I was hoping you were going to tell me what it is I'm playing.
No.
Because I don't know how to pronounce the guy's name.
Nor did I.
He's called Jake Xerxes, because it's spelt with an X.
Yes, that sounds right. Yeah.
Fussell.
So, yeah.
But it is a bit folky.
Yeah.
In fact, it's very folky. It's one of those great American records where you feel like the music lives in this guy. And I imagine, I've not even seen a picture of him, I imagine he's quite a big guy.
I did see a picture.
A bit like a trucker or something.
Yeah. You know, he has that.
He's got the music in him and he's in the music.
Mm.
And I thought, I'm not going to... These days, I almost don't want to know because there's too much information about people. Mm-hmm. So I haven't really looked him up. But I do know that he... I don't know where I learned this, but I know that he was kind of born in the South, in the Deep South. His father was some kind of folklorist and he used to travel around with his dad. So, yeah, I guess he soaked up all this music from an early age. And, I really like it. And this song, I worked this out after a while, it's some kind of fisherman's cry. It's an old fisherman's song.
Right, let's give it a listen. It's Jake Xerxes Fussell with the River St. John's.
St. John's. I got mullets. They are fresh and fine. You can buy them off a dime. They are just from the river St. John, St. John. They are just from the river St. John. They are just from the river St. John, St. John. They are just from the river St. John.
And lastly, back by popular demand, the album No One Likes But Me. This is where we take outwardly sensible humans and reveal that they are deeply, deeply flawed individuals. You'll be hearing the case for two, what I say, fairly shocking albums. But, I mean, you know, go on, you're here to... The first is Pop by U2.
Listen.
As chosen by Nadia Shireen. And, let's get this right, it's Oxymoxoa.
Aoxymoxoa. It's a palindrome.
Yeah, we know, but...
It's a lysergic palindrome.
Ooh.
Okay, by the Grateful Dead. Here are two extracts to get us in the mood. There are warnings, right? One, the first one contains all the tracks from Pop, the album, played simultaneously, as I was hoping it would shed new light on this album because I find it really difficult to listen to one after another. And two, features nitrous oxide vocals, and I think some of them are backwards at some point.
Hi.
You've got,
I've gone for Pop by U2 because when you said an album that everyone hates, it would have been really easy for me to do a humble brag and be like, oh, I just, you know, I actually really like this this Alice Coltrane record that like not many people liked, but actually it's really great. I could have done that, but no, I thought let's do something which everyone actively will hate, and choosing U2 I think was quite brave of me.
Yes, it was.
Yes, I think so, because it's difficult to defend you two.
Yeah, it is. Tell us why you have a connection with this record, because there's a beating heart underneath this, isn't there? There's something you like about it.
There's something you look so pained. So the thing is, it's very hard to defend you two, so you've done it, everyone listening, and I have to do this as well. We're just going to have to put Bono to one side. Okay, I have to do that as well. Yeah. We all have to put Bono to one side. Okay. I recognise he's a problematic arsehole. I am 40 years old, so I was about 13 or 14 when I think Acton Baby came out, and I was into it.
Yeah,
I really loved it. I thought it was really interesting and exciting and great. And I also really liked Europa. I got well into the whole thing. And I make no apologies for it. Okay, I did apologise quite a lot. I liked lots of other music at the same time, but I did like those two albums a lot, and I got into U2. While seeing that he was an arsehole, but not quite, I think I was still young enough to just be able to kind of go, but he's just a mega pop star, and now they're kind of laughing at themselves, and the Pet Shop Boys have told me it's okay to kind of like them now, because they've sort of got a sense of humour about themselves. They went on and did Passengers with Brian Eno, which contains Miss Sarajevo, which I still think is a beautiful song. And then they kind of, pop was, so pop followed on from Passengers. And so it's really, I think, still quite out there, very experimental. It was a massive commercial failure. U2 have kind of erased its existence. They don't talk about it anymore. You know, they've disowned it completely. Mm. I think it's the last time they were interesting. And okay. I think the nail, you know, I think anything they did after that is just, you know, absolutely dull. And I think the reason it's quite interesting is they hadn't quite decided where they were going. They still had the kind of, I think it's produced by Howie B and Flood. And I think they're still carrying that spirit of adventure into kind of electronic music that they had during Zooropa and during Passengers, where they worked with Brian Eno. Larry Mullen had hurt his back, so he wasn't involved in the recording sessions. And I think Larry Mullen Jr. is quite... I don't know much about the machinations of how you two work musically, but I think Larry Mullen Jr. is quite a traditionalist.
Yeah.
I think he was probably like, came back from pop and went, oh, this is rubbish, let's do our proper. I think Larry Mullen Jr. strikes me as being very, let's do proper rock music, guys. And I quite like this because you can hear that they're a bit off the leash. It's muddy, it's confused, it's weird, it's quite creepy, but there are some interesting sounds on there. There are some weird tracks on there. I mean, Miami, Mofo, these are all really weird tracks.
Yeah.
I think if Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds had done If You Wear That Velvet Dress, which is a song at the end, and Wake Up Dead Man, I think those songs would be considered to be great songs. But the problem is you've got Bono doing it, so no one does. So that's kind of... I can't defend all of the album. There's a lot of dross on there.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's... I think Dyed in the Wool U2 fans have completely disowned it. Because I'm not a Dyed in the Wool U2 fan, I think I can listen to it and go, you know what, there's some all right stuff in there.
Okay.
So that's what I've said.
You've
about
made
pop.
The case quite well.
Have I?
They'd also,
not bad, actually,
they'd also stopped ripping off Echo and the Bunnymen by then as well.
Well.
Which is a good point.
Yes.
Bono said it's like some extended demo that it's not really finished.
Yeah, they didn't. I think they felt it was
that old chestnut. Yeah,
too busy touring the world, he said.
Yeah, I think that's probably a load of bollocks, really. So I think he's famous for coming out with
I think I've just realised the problem I have with Brittany Kaiser.
Right.
She wears one of those kind of white cowboy hats like Bono did throughout that documentary.
She does make some sartorial... Yeah, she and Bono have a lot in common sartorially, I think.
No,
it's fine. Also, it was 1997. So if you think about what's happening in music...
Oh, yeah.
In general, 1997 is the dark year. Yeah, 1997 is the Britpop hangover. Mm-hmm. U2 didn't know what to do with themselves during Britpop, hence they budded off and made ambient records with Brian Eno.
Yeah.
So pop is, I think, such an interesting and flawed and weird record because of all of these reasons. And I like a bit of weirdness and a bit of darkness, and I do think pop has that here and there.
Have you ever persuaded anyone to listen to this? Have you come out of the closet about this?
No. Not really, because it's very difficult to come out of the closet with you two.
Yeah.
I wouldn't come out with the whole album, but I would isolate a few tracks and go, listen to this, and it's actually quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not yet had the opportunity to do so until today.
Fine. Do you have a most... is there a track that is the most difficult on it? Anything that you would skip? You said there's a few.
Oh, so the tracks that I would skip would be... they released a single called Staring at the Sun, which is just the most boring YouTube ballady song ever. And I think that's the stuff that's why people don't like U2. Whereas if you listen to a song like Miami, you'd be like, who is this? Because it's off his tits. I would skip Staring at the Sun, which is the ballad.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, the ballad. So, Mick, from U2 to the Grateful Dead, you've chosen Aoxamoxa.
Almost,
wasn't it?
Aoxamoxa.
That's right. And we played What's Become of the Baby earlier on.
How much did you play?
30 seconds, I'm afraid.
It lasts for 8.5 minutes.
Yes, it does. That's why we played 30 seconds.
Hey, at least you got a bit of an actual song played.
That's true.
Conversely, does it have any hits on it?
No, it doesn't have any hits on it. Mm. It does have two songs that became staples of their live set.
Yeah.
But, I should explain. I this was the first Grateful Dead album I bought.
Yeah.
This was in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And I was an impoverished student at the time. So if you bought a record, if you bought an album, you sure as hell made sure you grew to like it somehow.
You had to make yourself like it.
You worked at it. You worked at it. And you had to work with this album because... Mm. It's just all over the shop. This was the Grateful Dead, who I'd only read about at that point, who were known for this. They were kind of a blues band that took loads of drugs and went off into these kind of experimental jams. And suddenly you're confronted by an album with a couple of things that almost sound like that, but they stop before they get started. And most of it's acoustic. It's quite folky. Mm. And then you get to... What Becomes of the Baby, which is basically, I think, music concrete, if that's how it's pronounced. Mm. That makes it sound more like
a
pudding. Music concrete. And it's just... Jerry Garcia, does the vocal, if it can be called a vocal, and his voice is processed and treated, and he has been sucking in, what is it, nitrous oxide through a tube.
Yes.
But on top of that, there's loads of weird electronic effects. And it does kind of whoosh around.
Yeah, and lots of backwards as well.
Lots of backwards stuff and sound effects and gongs. And,
do you have to take nitrous oxide to listen to it?
I've never actually tried.
Haven't you?
No.
Don't do it, kids, as I say.
No, it's terrible. Don't do it.
But do you know, are you alone then in the love of this album?
I'm probably not, but I think the point I was trying to make earlier was that, I bought it in 1969. And I liked the Grateful Dead. And it was okay to like the Grateful Dead for a few years. But through most of the time when I, got into doing PR, there were groups you just... Even, it was cool that I could have a conversation with Julian Cope about Sid Barrett or Love. But you kind of didn't mention the Grateful Dead to anybody because Grateful Dead just tagged you as some kind of... Deadhead, old hits.
Right. So I was about to say, I only know people who are all or nothing about the Grateful Dead. So I know someone who's a deadhead.
It's like that,
and it's all he likes.
Yeah, it's kind of that. It's like I wouldn't want to be a member of a club that that you're a member of, kind of thing. So for years, you're either ridiculed for liking the Grateful Dead, or you just keep quiet about it. But the thing about this album is this is the album that even Grateful Dead fans don't like.
Right, OK. Is it the sort of album that, party? It's getting a bit late. Put that on. Everyone's off.
I think you put that on or Lou Reed's Metal Machine Music. And
hey, that's a great joke. Can I quickly mention the album that you...
Sorry, at the same time.
Yeah, yes, at the same time.
Actually, you wouldn't notice, but, there'll be nobody left.
Then put on The Flame and Lips, Zyreka. Have a three-way.
Okay.
Can I quickly mention the album that you wouldn't let me have, that we were going to talk about?
Yes.
I wanted to raise Paul McCartney's Press to Play.
Yeah.
Which is in the right slap bang in the middle of his 80s period.
Yep.
And I just want to quickly say, listeners...
to mention it.
I just wanted
to mention
it. I just want to say, guys...
Yeah. I had to
just
watch
listen,
that YouTube video.
Just listen to Pretty Little Head and to the lead single, Press. and then come back to me with your thoughts. Thank you.
All right, yeah, write in, not to Facebook, to Twitter.
Write into Sian's Twitter feed, not mine.
Fine, and on that note, we're coming to the end of the show. You. It means closing time chatter, of course. What will our guests be talking about as they finish off the last mojito in an unnamed infinity pool in Thailand before they go and delete their Facebook profiles? Nadia, what have you brought in for us?
So what I have brought in for you is that, are you aware of BTS?
Only just. They are okay. A K-pop band, are they not?
They are a K-pop band, but they are absolutely flipping massive.
It sounds a bit like IBS, I always thought.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. I think there are 7 members. Yeah. I'm not a big BTS aficionado. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know much about them, apart from that they are huge. And that they have had, I think, 3 number one albums in the US charts within a year. Mm-hmm. And are the first band since the Beatles to do
that.
Yeah, so that's pretty huge. They are mega. The VMAs, the Video Music Awards, the MTV VMAs, to include them, have created a K-pop category rather than just having them there as best band, best K-pop act.
Yeah.
And there's been a bit of a hubbub online about this.
Certainly has.
Where people are suggesting that this is actually quite racist and quite patronising.
Yes.
And they're kind of, well, if we're going to include you in our little pop party, we better make a special category for you. And I have some sympathy with that view.
Yeah.
I have no, you know, I don't know much about BTS, but I do have a, that clearly they are massive.
Yeah.
And why...
They are popular. And they are popular. That's what the VMAs is about.
It is about popular pop music. And I think the kids, in inverted commas, who are downloading and streaming... Yeah. Are baffled by this, and rightly so.
Again, I think it may be the leather patches on the corduroy jackets making those decisions.
I think it may well be. Who makes the decisions for the VMAs?
I don't know. That's the new Netflix documentary.
No, but
that's
it is. I read a piece about this, and it did say, oh, it's all very shady. Mm. It's presumably just some MTV suits who are looking at their quarterly results and looking at what's going to happen
quarterly
in the next
quarterly results, year. That's the name for a band, if ever there was one.
Isn't it? Or a Pet Shop Boys album.
Yes. Mick.
I did a talk last week with Bill Drummond about my book.
I'm glad you're both talking to each other. It's really good.
There we are. We do all the time.
Good.
Anyway, he does these 40-minute interviews, so he did one of his 40-minute interviews with me. And I didn't know what any of the questions were going to be in advance. But at one point, he put forward this idea that the two of us were going to be made ministers of culture in the new Boris government. What will we do? What will we do about it? Mm. So, of course, immediately we became, because we're both in our mid to late 60s, we immediately became two old codgers sitting on a park bench just saying, oh, we should ban festivals. We should ban groups reforming.
Yeah.
Both of which I kind of wish would happen.
Yeah.
But at the same time, one, I don't need to ban festivals because I just don't go to them.
Yeah.
And groups reforming and making albums I never want to hear is fine because I think it's great that there is an income source for people who probably 10, 15 years ago wouldn't have had one. So I was trying to think of just something sensible that came out of this conversation that we should ban. And maybe you should ask your readers. I'm back in the print reader again.
Yeah.
Listeners to vote for something. And I did think that you could actually have as the new Minister of Culture, you could actually ask people to write in. You'd have to actually write a letter, put it in an envelope, stick a stamp on it with your idea for something that you think should do to change pop culture.
But I don't believe in banning anything. To add to culture what we need. Yeah, maybe we should do an extra show about this.
Is it simplistic to just say I want black women to run everything?
But why not?
Is it simplistic and offensive and quite a broad brushstroke statement? Just let's see.
But why not?
Have a bash.
I think that's the problem. You come up with all these broad brushstroke things, and everyone I came up with, I thought, film shouldn't be more than 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And then I thought, actually, most of my favourite films are actually 1 hour 40 minutes or 1 hour 50 minutes.
No.
So you said, we should ban all films that are over 2 hours. And then I thought, actually, no, that...
See, what you end up with...
That means all my favourite Sam Peckinpah films.
You can't do the banning. You have to do the raising.
Everybody should be nice to each other in the end, don't you? Because that's as reductive as you can be.
I know, right?
Yeah. It's a tricky one. Well, keep thinking about it. I'd be interested if you and Bill Drummond...
Another thing you said really interested me, though. Sorry, I know we're probably running out of time, but I wanted to know, are there any bands who've staged a comeback that have actually released a good album
Specials.
In the comeback years?
Specials album's quite good, actually.
Is it?
Yeah.
Actually, okay. Echo and the Bunnymen staged a comeback and made a great single.
Is this Nothing Ever Lasts Forever?
Nothing Lasts Forever.
I bought that.
But the album is a bit... It's about 50-50.
Nothing Ever Lasts... No, I won't go into it now.
So, maybe later.
I can't think of any others.
No.
I haven't heard the Specials. So.
It's not bad. Yes. I mentioned her earlier. My closing time chatter is that sometimes when I'm feeling lonely and a little down, I do look at the Real Iman Instagram account and look at her memes.
I am obsessed with these.
Because I thought she's just reading them off a tea towel or there's some sort of cushion in her house. She's making them up, isn't she?
They are mental.
I now don't know what you're talking about, so carry on.
Iman, yes. Iman,
Nadia, do you...
So Iman, model, was married to David Bowie for a time, is on Instagram. And she posts these huge motivational messages, the kind that you would find upon a fridge magnet.
Yes,
and I'm going to read some out now.
Innocent smoothie.
Believe it into existence. Hashtag Iman Daily. Gratitude is a muscle. Exercise it. Hashtag Iman Daily. Oh my God.
There's some good ones in there.
There are some good ones.
There's a lot about her being like a sassy bitch, and that's what she's going to be. And at first I thought, well, these seem a little bit hackneyed and derivative, and I'm now really into them.
I like them.
To the point where, yeah, I'll stick that up on the fridge and maybe I'll live that today.
Be the kind of woman that when your feet hit the floor each morning, the devil says, oh crap, she's up.
That's just brilliant.
Do you reckon she punched the air when she came up with that
one? Oh, I do. And I love the thought. She's always said that Bowie was really, really encouraging. I don't know, as we know, some husbands aren't encouraging, but said things like, yeah, do your makeup range, yeah, just be a kick-ass model, just be brilliant, and that he is somewhere just
your memes, love,
punching the air going, do the memes. And I love the thought that maybe if Bowie had been a little bit younger, he just had done memes on Instagram. Go into space,
become
it's
a meme
an oddity.
I'm going to become a meme artist.
So I just love them. I just drop all cynicism and go, and if it's not a hell yes, it's a no, she says. I mean, you know, come on, let's live our lives this way.
And also, I said, also, I like imagining it in her voice and maybe with her stroking a panther. Because she's quite terrifying, I think, isn't she?
Only if her voice has been fed through a nitrous oxide tube.
Iman would never do that. I think that's how she speaks.
No.
Really?
I think
she's secretly... Do you think Iman was up for a bit of nitrous oxide?
I do, yes.
I'm not saying that. Sian's saying that, lawyers.
Yeah, sorry. Right, that's the end of the show. It has to be. Thank you, Mick Houghton, and thank you, Nadia Shireen. I hope you're up to lots of exciting things. Not going to ask you because you bang on for hours about it.
Sorry.
But
I'm going to go and watch another 14 episodes of Manifest.
Of course. Nadia's got wonderful children's books out, and Mick has wonderful Fried and Justified out now. Thanks to producer Alex Rees. Remember, you can hear all of our past episodes, if you're completely mad, at audioboom.com/bigmouth. If you want to support the show, and please do, you can buy us a pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. Link is also at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. But until then, please do remember...
Ladies and gentlemen, we're floating in space.